So the community and physical environment group.
Okay, I'd first like to thank Samantha for taking notes for our group earlier and for continuing to take wonderful notes now for the benefit of all of us. And then I would like to beg forgiveness from Lorette in the sense that our group took Terry's advice to think outside the box literally, and we in fact changed the box, so to say. And we did this for several reasons. And in one sense, we feel, you know, a little disadvantaged about going after the social norms group, in the sense that we really couldn't separate our group from any humanity, in that sense. Our group, another way we changed things is that we changed the name of our group. We are no longer just the community and physical environment. We are now the community and built physical environment, for a very good reason. The physical environment kind of gives the impression that we are accepting the environment as it is, whereas we have the perception that it's more about how we shape our environment, the transportation highways or venues that we construct, the buildings, the paths between our homes and our occupations, that made a little bit more sense to at least start moving forward and to connect it with humans. So we did that. And second, instead of focusing only on obesity, we felt that the built environment doesn't really impact obesity, you know, per se. It's more of a secondary relationship in the following sense. You can build bike paths in your city or put sidewalks near the road, or you can put soccer or tennis courts in vacant lots, but that's not going to make people use them. It's the behavior of the people that needs to correspondingly change along with an improved built environment. So instead of focusing on obesity, we thought more that behavioral change was slightly more appropriate to look at. Third, sometimes I can't read my own writing. It's easy for us inside a metropolitan city to think of a built environment as a city or a town. But as we've learned in the last 2 days, there's many different types of communities. There's urban versus rural. There's suburban. There's what might be a developed nation or an underdeveloped nation. Communities mean different things across the board. So because of that, we thought that creating a list of variables, so to say, might be a little fruitless, because what might count as a descriptor or an outcome in one community might not necessarily translate over to another. Thank you. So instead of, again, creating a list of variables, which already Mark Daniels did a wonderful job this morning coming up with a list of variables that we can look at, and instead of just reiterating those, we decided to form a more general construct that we can then apply to any type of community. So in doing that, we thought about the different ways in which people interact with their community or their built environment. And the simplest way of seeing this is how do individuals interact between their homes and their work? I know in some studies when they think about how active a subject is or inactive, they focus on, or you know, what are their eating habits, they focus on a radius around the home. Well, they forget that most people spend more awake hours at work as opposed to at home. Most people eat their food away from their house, or they at least obtain it not in a direct line from their house to a restaurant or to a grocery store, but from work to those places. So, of course, you know, within all of those, there's many different levels. How exactly are you traveling between those kind of places? Are you walking? Are you taking the subway? Are you driving your own car? So that also takes into account. The other kind, aside from home and occupation, is leisure. Do you leave your house or do you leave your occupation to perform leisure activities? What kind of leisure activities do you then engage in? And then last, familial obligations. That's just a fancy way of saying chores. Things like going out and buying clothes for your children or just taking care of things away from the home. And in each of these, there's commonalities between them. Again, we've already talked about how you travel to get to these places. Safety is another concern. Some people simply will not do things if it is unsafe to do so. The food availability at each source, and the acquisition of that food. Are you simply going to a fast food restaurant because it is easy to obtain it? Or would you rather go somewhere where it might be a little bit more intensive to obtain nutritious food, but you would just rather do so? And then lastly, the options for physical activity. Again, these are all things that apply to all those different nodes. If you have a gym close to your house but not close to your work, how you measure the proximity of a gym really depends on how you answer that question. Again, if you only focus on a residence, you might overlook the fact that many people have gyms in their office, or there's a gym at least close to it. So all those things we thought was important. But what's important about that is nowhere in there are we making a specific definition that doesn't apply to different types of communities. So the next part, and again, you know, we try to keep things a little bit general so that it's thus more applicable. So we have, again, these nodes of interaction with the built environment that consist of any of those type of things that I just mentioned. So first, again, as I already mentioned, there are differences between the community types. So while the nodes would stay the same, what actually constitutes that node would change. The easiest example is the difference between an American city and a European city. North American and Canadian schools or cities are designed so you can drive into the center of it, do what you have to do, be at work, leisure, handle your chores, and then get right back out. It's a lot more difficult to do that due to traffic or whatever other concerns. But it's still designed so that you can drive to the precise location that you want. European cities, on the other hand, are a little bit different. They're designed so that you cannot penetrate that center of the city with a car. So it takes a little bit more involvement to do it. Those are two different types of communities. Measuring the built environment with a similar set of variables in that case might not be optimal. Next, there's a difference between urban and rural communities. It almost goes without saying that you would be measuring different things. People would be going about their business and interacting with that built environment in completely different ways. For instance, why would an agrarian culture have a subway system? And why would they need to walk to it? So in that sense, again, there's just not really a common set of variables to throw between them. And then lastly, there's, as was already mentioned numerous times, there's just differences between cultures. Part of that explains some of the difference between the American and the European cities, or the North American and the European cities. Even in just differences between Asian and Western cities, there's just large cultural differences that, again, prohibit a common set of variables. But if you think in the term of constructs, like our nodes of involvement, then things kind of make sense, and you at least have a framework that you can compare across those different cultural types. And then lastly, we didn't really get to talk too much about this. We only hinted at it right before lunch started. But there are also natural differences in built environments. For instance, right behind us, there is a hill that affects how you build your environment, whether or not you are surrounded by water on three sides or four sides like Manhattan. That affects how you build your environment. Climate was also mentioned via question during the last group. That is also going to determine how different cultures or different places build their communities. All right. So when we actually started to get a little bit more serious and try to say, okay, it's nice to think about these as a node of involvement, in a community sense, but how exactly does that help us moving forward? And that's where we kind of came up with some trouble staying within our realm of just the built environment. And you really cannot separate your built environment from the people that constitute it, from the cultures, the societies. You just cannot do it. So in that sense, Instead of, you know, thinking about how the environment itself is affecting obesity, what we decided to do is think instead that it's the policy change that you could inflict on that environment that might be able to affect things. For instance, instead of just looking whether or not your bicycle paths are actually helping subjects improve their health, maybe it's more as you institute that policy, is there an improvement in behavioral change? In the fact that if you build it, do the people come to it and actually use it? So we're coming up with another problem. How exactly do you test whether or not people's behaviors are changing? There were several papers that we considered looking at the fact that most people, when you build a bicycle path or sidewalk, most of the people that use it have already been using other bicycle paths or other walkways before. So how exactly do you test that? How can you see what proportion are new subjects that are using those kind of things? Right, so as far as a methodological point of view, we didn't really come up with one kind of catch-all methodology that we'd want to use because, you could theoretically use anything depending on the data that you're collecting. But we thought that in the spirit of collaboration between the obesity research and the systems modeling is that this would be a nice opportunity to do that. We have plenty of data that explain the built environment and how, for instance, having bike paths can lead to better health if you use it. So the real point is we have that data. We know that it does improve people's health if they use it. So how exactly are we going to determine if we change this built environment, how are we going to determine the effect that it has? And so simulations is one nice way that we could go about doing this. We can use the actual data that we have to form a template of our built environment and the subjects that populate it, and then change that template based on some hope for policy decision. If we decide to cut off most of the main arteries into a city, how is that going to not improve people's health so much, but how is that going to change their behaviors about being healthy? The agent-based modeling, the systems-based approach, any of the methods that were talked about yesterday, we feel can be applicable for those ends. So I hope in that short speech that we at least showed that we at least covered all the parts in the matrix. Again, the variables we didn't really cover because we felt that a more general construct would be better. And as far as the connections and pathways to the other groups, it almost appeared self-evident to us. The built environment is a non-human construct, but it's populated by humans who, one, form communities, and two, who are making individual decisions based on their communities and their individual constitutions. So in that sense, we felt that in a modeling approach, any type of the other considerations that we had today would have to have been taken into account. Half of our group is left at this point. So I hope I didn't misconstrue anything that any of the anyone else said. But if anyone else from our group has some comments, that would be great.
I'd like to add one more component, which I think I mentioned during our discussion also, that household level activities and the construction of house and other things which have not been considered as a strong variable in the built environment till now. Maybe that has to be considered also, as Bikramji was also talking, that the construction which was inward and outward, I don't know the names and other things, but they do affect your activity at a daily level rather than going to only work or school or outside, but where you live most of your day and night.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Clearly, there's many ways to think exactly of what the community is. You can start at the home level. You can start at your block level, and it can continue to go up. And that was one of the problems we faced as a group. Is where exactly down the hierarchy are we going to focus our attention? So yeah.
Another question?
I enjoyed your summary. So one of the big problems that often I see in scientific review at NIH on these kinds of connections where people are trying to look at space and health is that, as you pointed out, there's non-random sorting into cities, neighborhoods, and so forth that are sometimes health-related. Mm-hmm. And so the event that you take these notions of one direction, and I think this was problematized with the supply and demand argument about this, then the simulation won't really tell you how effective the implementation of a whatever intervention you think is useful. So as I was thinking about this, I think it's a well-known problem, I was trying to think of ways of getting around it or addressing this issue, and it's a big issue, and many people are struggling with it. I'm reminded of some of the data we were given a preview of the other day, and seeing in the development of India an almost natural experiment. And India was the example we've been given, but I'm sure there's many others. And so, but where you may have a population that doesn't have the ability, for a variety of reasons, to non-randomly sort, but their physical environment is changing. And I think there's an exciting reviewable kind of thing going on there that should be considered. But in any event, maybe I'm thinking out too much. But I enjoyed your presentation. Thank you.
No, that's again, there wasn't a unanimous consent in our group about what type of modeling to use. You know, we range from the purely methodological observation based to, you know, almost purely simulation based. I think in this case that since there is already so much existing data, that a hybrid approach would be appropriate. But you know, again, yeah, I completely agree in the sense that there are many living experiments that we could also use to see exactly how you know, as you're building up your community, what different types of decisions work as opposed to those that don't.
So actually, just adding on to Mike Spittle's comment, I mean, we do fund studies, for example, looking at smart growth communities, and there is some degree of random sorting because oftentimes sorts are based on lotteries, in terms of who gets to actually be selected, you know, to move in. That happens also with like low-income housing in New York City. We're working with New York. There's an emergence of emphasis on the design and architecture of microspace, so work buildings, you know, residences, schools, and New York City is actually going to come out with an active building code fairly soon that's going to be applied to all, you know, city buildings, city-owned buildings. There's also movement to add health components to the LEED certification process with the U.S. Green Building Council. And so as these things, you know, become more and more standardized, you know, there will be ways to actually benchmark and, you know, compare findings across projects and across studies.
And it's funny, Terry and I work in the same institute, but this is the first time we're really talking about this. I didn't want to brag about the work in our portfolio, but we have stuff like that too. And what I wanted to say was, as you were talking, I realized maybe that addresses the question you've been posing all along. And the thing is, the scientific community as represented here would not be here if they weren't dealing with the kind of things they have to do, the publications, the rigor, and so forth. And so many of us are ill-equipped to think of what it is that are policy levers, because that's not what a lot of the people here do. But when you can find a way to take advantage of something that's on the horizon, for whatever reason, in this case, a moving to opportunity study, which is something that my branch has funded, doing a random, taking advantage of a lottery, you are addressing a concern that a policymaker may have, and one where the scientific community may have. And I think it's thinking like this where we are going to have opportunities to do the question, which I think you've been pushing us to think about.
Well, and just on that note, I mean, we already have a couple of program announcements out in the field that are open to, you know, anybody who want to come forth, you know, with teams of obesity researchers and policymakers to address policy-relevant questions. And probably within the next couple of weeks or so, there'll be another set of program announcements being released that focus specifically on policy evaluation, on the one hand, more generally, and then school-based policy, which was separated out as a separate program announcement. So I think that we as a funding agency, you know, are moving in that direction to generate some of the practice-based evidence, if you will, that Diane was talking about, to hopefully fill in the gaps. And people should, we encourage people, you know, to really think along those lines.
I just wanted to ask a bit about, you mentioned the connections between the built environment and the social environment, how it is that it's really individuals who are moving within those environments, and whether the question of like a differential vulnerability by specific types of population subgroups came up. I know that in some of the work we're doing here, like age may be an important factor, that is the built environment and have a greater influence on older adults. Or we found in a study we're doing here that it tends to be low-income individuals who have those within neighborhood connections, as opposed to higher-income individuals have ties way beyond their particular residential setting. So that when we think about these environments and their possible impacts, again, it kind of takes us, to me, it makes us kind of have to think outside the like a standard population health approach and consider how it is that particular groups or subgroups in society are maybe more or less vulnerable to particular types of environmental effects. And I just, maybe if you could say a little bit about that.
Absolutely. That was actually one of the sources of largest disagreement in the group. Not really so much disagreement, but just the inability to come to some kind of consensus about what exactly to do. Certainly there are things being done, and I wish Mark was here, Mark Daniels. He had a lot to say on that when we met in group. But yeah, it's there's clearly a million different ways you can talk about it. We did not come to a consensus on it.
And actually, just on that note, you know, we have a couple of funding opportunities where we're supposed to specifically looking for existing longitudinal data or cohort data, you know, even large-scale population-based cross-sectional data, where you can add contextual and geographical information on top of your existing database. And so because it's more likely that in those population-based data, you know, that are already in existence where you can find sort of individual level information and potentially fairly easily, you know, in new waves of data collection, add surveys or interviews or whatever other methodologies that you use, how individuals interface with their environment. But you still really need the actual contextual and geographical information on top of that to really make sense of the relationships. So that's another opportunity where, you know, people can take advantage, you know, of these calls for proposal.
So what we'd like to do now is spend a little bit of time just sort of talking about how we can integrate some of the comments. And so part of this is thinking about where is the potential for collaboration? What are the kinds of questions that were coming up as you're looking at the various presentations about data and thinking about what kinds of data sources might we use? And one of the things I was struck by was in terms of the question about models or methods and things like that, there may be some pieces we could actually sort of talk about, either in terms of what it is that needs to be clarified or what kinds of projects might be most appropriate for which methods. So thinking back to the seven presentations, what in general were some of the connections or potential collaborations that you were thinking about? across these seven presentations.
I'm digressing a little bit, not talking about collaborations, but after hearing these seven presentations from the seven groups, a couple of things are emerging that there are some variables which appear at multiple places. Similarly, pathways which appear at multiple places. And how do you handle in a real-life situation when the same variables are appearing at multiple levels? The second is that if we have to do this multi-level modeling, what should be the approach, or how do you select what the issue you are also raising, how to select a particular type of modeling technique, and for those, what kind of variables are to be focused on specifically? The variables which appear at multiple places, what is their significance? Do they become more important, or how should that also be handled in these modeling exercises?
So I think that, you know, we designed this workshop really to initiate the conversation and really kind of, you know, get us some base materials to work with. And then there's going to be an iterative process after today to really fine-tune and maybe even expand on what's been presented today to get at some of those specific questions that you're talking about. Well, seeing that it's late in the day and also people are leaving, and most of the people have left already, actually, maybe we can just get a couple of the people who were listed to help us, you know, wrap things up and maybe just share some personal reflections on, you know, what we've been doing, as well as, you know, where we should go next. So maybe, Antoine, you want to maybe say a few words if you have some thoughts? I see that Lorette's put you on the agenda.
Okay. Well, we heard very, very great thoughts today, but I look at this in a very simplistic way, because it looks like we're spending too much time trying to figure out what causes obesity, and the solution is actually very simple: eat less and exercise more. Now, I won't give you, but the question is, how can you make people do that? So exercising is a painful phenomenon from a brain perspective. So I'm not going to talk about that, since it's Friday the 13th and we're at the very end of the day. But let's, you know, I'll give you just one thought about, well, how can we fool the brain to eat less? And hopefully at the next meeting we will see half the attendants are from marketing, from economics, and from the business people, because we like to know what is it that they can do, what they cannot do, and what sells and what doesn't sell. It's very easy for us here to sit down and talk about how bad McDonald's is, but what do you want them to do? Stop selling Big Macs? You know, make lettuce instead? People won't buy it. But the question is, I think we have to pursue something different. Now, here's one crazy idea. I mean, I haven't thought it very well, but what the heck? We know, for example, as far as the brain is concerned, it tries to maximize dopamine release. You know, when there is a reward, it tries to maximize that dopamine release. So that dopamine release can be maximized by having a big, large meal, a high-energy food, and so on. But it can do it through other means as well. And I'll tell you in a second how, you know, like one idea. But today in one of the meetings, I heard that some girls smoke in order to lose weight. Well, how does that happen? Actually, I mean, although there are probably several different possible mechanisms, but one obvious mechanism to me is that you could substitute a lot of food, you know, with
less food, and the cigarette, because the cigarette causes dopamine release in the brain as well. So the brain can receive the same amount of dopamine by eating a lot of food alone or by eating less food and a cigarette with it. Now, I don't recommend at all using any drugs to substitute for food. But there are other mechanisms, because we know that dopamine is sort of a common currency in the brain. That is, all types, all forms of rewards can trigger ultimately the same mechanism of dopamine release. For example, food triggers dopamine, but so do other forms of non-food rewards, like monetary reward, lottery, reward points, a gift. All those kind of non-food rewards can also trigger dopamine, and they are natural stimuli. So here's one crazy marketing proposal. I don't know, it has to be researched. It has to be worked out. But would it work out, for example, if you walk into a McDonald's and had a choice between having a very large meal or instead you have a choice between half the size of that meal, but with another non-food reward. That non-food reward has to be worked out. It can be a little gift for a little child. We'll tell you, we'll love it. Or for an adult, it could be in the form of a lottery. That is, you know, just you choose. You can either eat the big meal, or you can eat half of it with the chance to win a vacation to Hawaii, for example. Now, this has to be researched, but the question is, well, you know, can you formulate a business model of that? Would the business do it? Will they have an incentive to do it? Probably they do if it sells. Would people buy it? I would say yes, why not? But we have to test it. Now, you will never have all people. There's always going to be the people who want the big size Mac and the big size Coke, you know, no matter what. But if strategies like that, which are feasible, can change the mind of a certain percentage of the population, or at least part of the time. So in other words, not every time you go to McDonald's get the big size meal. You know, just some of the times and some other times. That could cause a lot of change, a lot of significant change at the aggregate level in terms of reducing obesity. Now, this is one crazy idea. Of course, one has to think about how do you do with other things, like when you go to the supermarket, what are you going to do with all those food products? But at least it's one idea about how knowledge about how the brain works probably can be translated into some advice about how marketers or how business industry should operate, instead of, you know, taking them as enemies and telling them, well, stop doing this product and stop doing that, because they're not going to do that they want to make a profit. Well, that's
maybe, Robert, you can